interesting how the students are all showing up this one week, right? You think that the parking lot would always be busy, but I guess with all these online courses today, they could take some courses at home. They could even listen to this podcast, right, and get their own MBA, you know, of starting a business, which I'm excited because we have Marty Schultz here, who's operated multiple businesses throughout his career, and currently he's the founder of Blindfold Games. So I'm going to introduce Marty to kind of tell us a little bit about his background and his current story. Marty Schultz, tell the audience listening a little bit about yourself.
Well, thanks for inviting me onto your podcast. Currently, I've been working with a company called Blindfold Games. I founded this about 4 years ago and has a really interesting backstory. Back in 2013, I think my daughter was about 11 or 12 years old, and before her birthday, every day she'd write up a new birthday wish list. So she'd take a piece of paper out, and she'd write what she wanted on that, and then she'd kind of show it to me and said, okay. And then the next day, she'd write another birthday wish list, and the next day, another birthday wish list. And I said, there should be an app for that. Why don't I create an app where kids could write their birthday wish lists, share it with their friends, and when it's finalized, whether it was for Christmas or Hanukkah or their birthday, they could then send it to their parents. So I thought I could either create this app and then focus test it with her friends, or I could make this into a STEM learning opportunity. I contacted the head of school where she attended and said, I want to run an after-school club for about 6 weeks and meet with the kids about 3 days a week for about an hour. And the kids and I will design a birthday wish list app. And the head of school, who was very, very forward-thinking, thought this is a great STEM learning opportunity for the kids, STEM being science, technology, engineering, and math. And after being fingerprinted and doing a full background search to make sure I wasn't a dangerous person, we launched the club. So the kids and I met 3 days a week for an hour after school, and together we built the app called Wish to List. And it let the kids come up with their birthday wish list, share it with their friends, rate each other's selections, and then in the end send it to their parents. We put into the app store. It didn't take off like most, like a success, but it was interesting enough, and the kids learned a lot and had a wonderful time. The head of school comes back to me and says, Marty, can you run the app club again and have the kid help teach the kids to build other apps? I said, great. And she said, oh, by the way, after you drop your daughter off in the morning, would you mind teaching the first period programming class for the middle school kids? So being an involved parent, I said yes to both. And we met with the kids in the app club in the second semester, and the kids said, we don't want to build some stupid, boring app. We want to build a game. And I said, okay, what kind of game do you want to build? Every game they came up with was like every other game in the app store. And I said, look, I don't mind teaching you how to build a game, but if we can do something, I want to be really different. And I told the kids, go off for 2 weeks and come up with something unique. They come back, and one of the kids came up with the idea of, what if we do something that doesn't need the screen? Because all the games in the app store always use a screen. I said, what do you mean? We started talking about it, and he said, let's make a driving game for blind people where you drive with your ears instead of your eyes. And you would use your iPhone like a steering wheel and listen to the track. So if the music gets louder in your left ear, it means you went too far to the left. If the music gets louder in your right ear, you went too far to the right. So you aim for noisy prizes like popping popcorn and avoid obstacles like barking dogs. Well, the kids and I built this app where during the app club, we would design new tracks and new rules for the games. And then at night, I'd go home and program another level. Then by the time we were done, we had finished the game to about 35 levels. The kids loved it. Of course, none of these kids were visually impaired. So a couple of my friends said, have you tested this out with any blind people? And I said, no. They said, well, maybe you should before you tell people you're building a driving game for blind people. I said, okay. I got a contact over with the Miami Lighthouse of the Blind, and I visited there, and we set up a Saturday where all the teens could come in who were visually impaired and play this game. We staged about 15 iPads. We actually had WSVN TV show up as well, and the teens played this game for about 3 hours, and they absolutely loved it. One of the teens even came up to me after they were playing with the game for a while, and they said, is the screen blank or dark while we're playing? I said, yes, because I want the same experience for sighted people as blind people. He said, well, you better put something on the screen, otherwise sighted people will think their iPad is broken. So I made that change. So I made that change to the game, and then we added about another 15 or 20 levels to the game, tested it out through the summer, and then we finally put it in the App Store. and it jumped to the top of the games that were accessible in the App Store list. And I started hearing from people all over the world about how much they love the game and how many more games they wanted. I happened to fly up to Boston, where I did most of my high-tech career, and I met with some people at the Perkins School. And at that meeting, I ended up meeting the woman who was the president of the American Council of the Blind and several other people who were high up in the Talking Book Program for the National Library of Congress. One of the people there asked me, can you make a 9x9 Sudoku game? And I said, you can play and fill out a Sudoku chart, and you can't see the thing? You can't see the page at all? He said, yes. I said, okay, I can do a 9x9 Sudoku game. That'll take me about a month. Someone else at that meeting said, can you do a solitaire game? I said, yeah, that'll probably take 2 or 3 weeks to build, but I could probably build a solitaire game for the iPhone. Another woman at that meeting came back and said, I just got back from Las Vegas, where I played blackjack with a sighted friend of mine. Can you build a blackjack game? Well, it's like everybody started saying, oh, there's this guy out there who can build these games that are very accessible and fun. And I started hearing from people. So I started doing this in 2014. At this point, I've produced about 80 games.
Wow. Wow.
They're used by about 20,000 blind people worldwide.
Awesome.
And I think I've built a reputation that I've helped more blind people waste time than anybody else in the world.
So we got to get you in the world record over here.
So that's kind of the story of Blindfold Games. And it's very rewarding because every day I hear another thank you from somebody else somewhere in the world for the games I've done. There was one time a fellow who lost use of his legs and his vision due to a motorcycle accident. And he was an avid bowler in his teens. And now he's about 55 years old, and he was playing a game called Blindfold Bowling. And he writes to me saying, thank you so much for creating this game. I really missed bowling, and now you've brought the reality of bowling back for me. Every one of the games gives you the audio environment that makes you feel like you're there, with a blackjack game being like you're in a casino,
sure,
the bowling game being like you're in a bowling alley, the basketball game like you're in a basketball court and you're playing. So every one of the games has a wonderful soundscape, and the gestures are just so easy to the game that people just love to play them.
And how do they download these games? Is it on iPhone, Android devices, or website driven? How do they get to download these games?
All the games are available at the Apple App Store. And if people visit my website, which is blindfoldgames.org, they can get to a page that has a two-line description of each and every game. And then if they click on that link, they go right to the App Store to be able to download the game. And all the games are free to download to play for about an hour or so. And then if somebody really likes the game, it's the upgrades are somewhere between $3 and $7.
And how have you built this audience? Has it been word of mouth?
It's amazing how much word of mouth has affected the game's success. I remember, I tell this in one of my talks, which is when I first demonstrated Blindfold Racer, that very first game, the teens seemed to really enjoy the game because the day after I showed it to them, I had 25 downloads from the site, which means the teens told 25 of their friends about this game. Well, a couple of them posted it on a website for the blind, and the next week, we had about 200 people enjoying the game. That led to a few of these visually impaired people posting it on Facebook, and that led to me being interviewed on some podcasts, and every month, more and more people, thousands, were enjoying the game and telling each other about it. It's the community is very widespread, but there's a lot of word of mouth. There are a lot of Facebook groups. There's a lot of podcasts, a lot of different ways for people to spread the word, and we've done what we can to help spread that word. And to date, when I come out with a new game, I'll have anywhere from 5,000 to 20,000 people will test out the game, and a lot of them will end up upgrading for it.
Nice. So Kevin, what are your thoughts about the games that he's being invented over here?
It's such a great story, because I see so many students come through my classroom who want to develop apps, you know, and they're usually business students, so they don't necessarily have any technical expertise, which is a challenge in and of itself, but they want to develop the next big social media platform or the next something for everybody, right? And it's just a great example of how you don't really need to do that. You know, if you can focus on a very specific niche, in some cases, it can be easier to capture. Not that it's ever really easy, but you don't need to go after this huge billion-dollar market, whereas you can focus, you can solve a problem, arguably a problem, right? Maybe they're just wasting their time, but they want something to do, right? It's a need if it's not a problem, at a minimum, for a very specific group of people. And in some ways, that makes marketing a lot easier and in more and less expensive, right? More inexpensive.
We were just talking about that last week, right? About all these different trades that have leapt because everyone thinks these trades skills are not sexy, right? And, you know, you really can narrow down to a niche and grow from that niche. Just last week, think of Claudio, right? He had no background in tattoo removal, you know, and it all started really where he looked at an opportunity. He looked up all the statistics of how many folks had tattoos, and he created a solution, you know, within that niche. And now he has 8 stores, and he's grown to 3 or 4 more stores. So definitely niche. I think everyone tries to be too broad, you know. So let's jump into, Marty, your background. Like, how did you get to the point where you even were able to develop this app? You know, I have a lot of experience growing other companies. So let's touch base on that. Your beginning days running a business, and you've had some exits where a lot of folks cannot say they've had an exit of a company before. So tell us a little bit about that backstory.
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to have several exits. I think in every one of my companies, I've either had a successful exit or we took it public, especially the companies I invested more than a year of my life into. Of course, like anybody else, I've done ventures that I could tell after a few months weren't going to go anywhere, and I would abandon it.
Sure.
I think the very first company I built, say, not including some little experiments I did in high school where I started a McDonald's and Burger King delivery service for the students in the high school, where I kind of learned that the easiest way to build a business is to solve somebody's pain. And we would take orders for our friends for food from McDonald's and Burger King, and delivered to the school during lunch. And that business went really well for about 2 months before we were shut down by the cafeteria ladies for being too much competition.
Hey, I'm a big free market guy. I like the capitalist move there. Cafeteria food sucks. Get them see Marty. Bang. And you take a little off the top. I like it.
You were way ahead of the curve. You know, delivery dudes, you know, it's only been around for a few years. Uber Eats. And look at you.
Yeah.
You were doing delivery, you know, back in the cafeteria days.
So we had this cool idea. And I've definitely learned from that solving someone's pain is the easiest way to grow a company. The actual first company I built in the software arena, I was probably about 28 or so. And we saw an opportunity to take all the great software apps running on the big expensive mini computers and get them up and running on all these new Silicon Valley microcomputers. So we built some converter software, figured out how to sell it to what at that time were computer resellers, and launched that company. At that time, I had no idea how to turn an idea into a company and had to learn how to do everything myself. But by doing everything myself, it taught me really all the aspects of business, how to hire the right people, how to sell, how to support, how to collect money, all critical components that inevitably helped me build the other businesses I've had through my career.
Yeah. And what was the hardest point? You know, you wore a lot of different hats with all these different organizations, but where were your growing pains? What was the hardest hat to wear, you know, when you look at being an entrepreneur and running a successful business?
I think it was having to collect money. That was the hardest thing to do, because here you'd put all your time and effort into your product and you really valued what you were doing. Then you had to convince somebody to buy it. And then once you finally convinced them to buy it and you thought, okay, my job is done now, they should just pay me, they don't. And then you have to go and figure out how to collect money from them and how to solve their problems and support the customer. Every one of these things were learning opportunities. By learning how to do it correctly, I ended up knowing how to hire the right person for each job, evaluate their performance, and continue to motivate them.
Yeah.
After I did that company, I did another company in the fax and telecommunication and messaging space. I did start that one about 1991, and we took that public in 96. We actually just recently sold the rest of the stock we owned in that company back in 2017. And then in 2000, I started an educational technology company, which was just acquired at the end of 2016 in a strategic acquisition. In the mid-2000s, we saw an opportunity to come out with what's called parental control software. That's software that lets parents monitor what their kids are doing online. And this was back in the age when internet predators was a very big fear that parents had about their children online. And we built a product. It was doing okay, but we realized we needed a brand. And we convinced the National Crime Prevention Council, they're the people who owned the McGruff brand, don't know if you remember McGruff when you were growing up.
Scruff McGruff? Scruff McGruff. Of course.
Yeah.
He was all over the place, man.
In the cafeteria, always.
Yeah, and his motto was, take a bite out of crime. So we convinced the National Crime Prevention Council to let us license exclusively the McGruff brand in the digital world at almost no cost. And we launched that product, and it took off.
Neat.
So that one we actually were just about to raise money for and had some excellent term sheets in 2008. But if you remember what happened in August of 2008?
I think everybody remembers what happened around 2008. That's when I graduated with my MBA from the University of Florida and landed my first job, which was at the same gas station I had worked with at in high school. Well, tough economy, Palm Beach County, unemployment rate floating around 30%. It was tough. I know a couple of entrepreneurs who were right in the crux of raising money. I mean, even Scott Adams, the Adams Center's kind of namesake, right, was starting an accelerator that was a little bit kind of ahead of its time, right here in Boca Raton at the old IBM campus, and who knows what would have happened if the economy wouldn't have done what it did. You know, it's pretty unfortunate.
Well, that great term sheet we had in July kind of just disappeared in August.
Yep. Yeah. So, are you a gambler?
With my time, not with my money.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I might argue the other way. So I wanted to ask you about your experiences as an angel investor. Angel investing is one of the things where I focus some of my research, and the Angel Resource Institute has recently moved its headquarters to Florida Atlantic University. We do some research. We work with the ARI, Angel Resource Institute, to publish a biannual report called the HALO Report. And based on some of the numbers I see, it looks a lot like gambling. So tell us a little bit about your experience in that realm, you know?
I've been very reluctant to invest in any small organization, you know, be it one person, 10 or 50, where if I can't be part of the management team to make sure this company's going to go down the right path, I'm not going to put my money at risk.
Ah.
So I've looked at a lot of different offerings that have popped up. I'm part of a number of angel groups where I've sat in on their meetings looking for good stories. And they're few and far between. And the ones that even look good are way overpriced. It might do well for the CEO founder, but the investor is probably not going to see a return on their investment.
That's what it looks like by and large. By and large, angels, they fulfill a great need in the marketplace by helping businesses that otherwise wouldn't get funding because they're not ready for VC. And some of them do make money. Some of them may become unicorns even. But when we look at the returns data, it's not something that, on average, people who engage in it end up with a net profit. You know, if the saying is the house always wins, then the house is not the angels.
Yeah. I mean, venture capitalists have a different model, and they can invest in 20 different companies and have 19 of them float away, you know, not have a good return. But they'll probably stumble upon one very good return. Either it'll go public, it'll be acquired, it'll give them the return they need. It'll grow into that half.
Yeah, and it'll pay for all the rest.
Yeah.
Certainly. And you see some of the VCs kind of reaching a little bit into the earlier stages. Still not as early as what I'd say is like seed or traditional angel rounds, but you do see some different VC groups reaching earlier and earlier, which I think is a good thing because it gives people who might otherwise not have a shot without funding a shot. But yeah, it's the VCs know what they're getting into, though. They're like, yeah, we'll give you a shot. You'll probably fail. But as long as one of these, you know, out of 20 comes through, the yield is so high, compensates for the rest.
Right. It's a good deal if the VC can find it. For the entrepreneur himself or herself, it tends to not be such a good deal because if they don't have everything going correctly, the entrepreneur is not going to do well even with outside money. I believe very much in bootstrapping companies and maintaining control and only bringing money in when you don't really need it.
Yeah, which is the most optimal time to bring money in, of course.
Well, we're going to jump into bootstrapping in a moment. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we get back, we're going to jump into our Hot or Not segment of the show, so don't change the channel. Welcome back to the Shrimp Tank in the Boca Raton studio. I'm your host, Jason Hill, sitting with my co-host, Kevin Cox, the director over at the FAU Adams Center. We're having a really neat episode here. Going to interview Marty Schultz. You can catch an entire replay of the show at the Boca Raton Shrimp Tank Podcast.com, as well as the other episodes. So far, we've done 19 different episodes. You can check all them out at iTunes and start really, you know, doing a lot of learning from all these different entrepreneurs and figuring out, you know, your next story, you know. So definitely check out all these different entrepreneurs on our show. So we're going to jump into our next segment called Hot or Not. And Marty, we left off talking about bootstrapping. So right now, I have a feeling you're a big fan of bootstrapping a company and mentoring kids. So is it hot or not to bootstrap, you know, a company right now?
Definitely it's hot to bootstrap a company, because if you can bootstrap a company and figure out ways to do everything without using someone else's money, you'll maintain control until you know how you want to grow this company. If you try to bring in money from the outside, what's going to end up happening is all the things that the venture capitalist or investor will ask are things you can have to do anyway to grow your company. So you might as well simply do that, grow your company. And then once you've grown it to a point where you're making money, then you can bring in money.
All right. So what about cryptocurrency? It seems like it's been hot, then it's not hot, then there's regulatory changes. What are your thoughts?
It's one of the areas where I'm proud to say I know nothing about this, so I'm afraid to venture an opinion.
Hey, fair enough. Fair enough. Well, in that case, you're safe from the volatile fluctuations, at least, right?
Is it hot or not right now to do a business plan? You've had a lot of businesses. I'm sure you've had a lot of business plans. Are they out of style, or are they still here to stay?
I would always do a business plan, because if you don't know where you're aiming, there's no way you're going to get somewhere. And the important thing is not just a business plan, but a personal plan. If you don't know what you personally want to achieve out of the business might go in some direction that doesn't match your personal goals, and then you'll walk away frustrated after a few years.
Okay. What about just good old marketing? Let's get to that subject for a moment. You know, is it hot or not right now to market over the internet? Is it hot or not to do word of mouth marketing, or both? What's hot?
If you understand why your customer is buying what you're selling, you'll do well, and you're much better off having direct contact with the customer if you can figure out who those customers are. Just randomly throwing money at a pay-per-click ad or doing other things, you're not in control of the situation. The best way to become a successful entrepreneur is be in control of everything in the company, including who your customers are and how to target them.
So let's touch on that a tad, because you do a lot of mentorships, programs, you've spoken at a lot of events. You're a mentor at the FAU Tech Runway. Go into that marketing, because I think a lot of people just think that they could hire someone to figure it out on their behalf. And marketing is one of the most important elements of a company, right? You've had a corporation with 300 employees. It got there probably because of the marketing. That was kind of a lot of the foundation behind it. So go into detail of that marketing, how someone gets to that level.
You need to figure out, firstly, who are the customers who are actually going to spend money for what you're building. And the only way you're going to do that is to talk to them. And you'll end up finding that what they want is probably different than what you're selling. And until you change your pitch to match the pain that they're having, you're not going to sell anything. So before you do anything else, you need to talk to as many people as you can and figure out exactly why there's benefit to what you're doing. If there's no value proposition, if there's no upside to the customer, they're not going to save money or they're not going to grow their business, they're not going to buy you, no matter how great your marketing is.
Yeah, so talk to customers. If any of my students are out there listening, like I say all the time, you have to talk to customers. Now, Marty didn't say text someone who you already know that's probably not a customer. He said talk to another human who is potentially a customer and listen to what they say. This is a great way to find out what your customers value and what they'll exchange money for, as opposed to refusing to talk with them and presuming what they might want or sending a text to someone who's probably not in the demo.
This is a soft subject, I feel. So go into a little bit about what's going on at school. Is it only emailing and texting? You kind of dove deep into that.
It's a tough challenge to say. I make my students talk to – so they're starting micro ventures in my class, right? So anything. Whether they're ordering products from overseas that aren't in these markets, most of them are pretty simple. I don't care what they do. Make T-shirts. That'll be a little boring, but it's fine. Build something, you'll learn, right? From experiencing trying to build a company, even if it's something that bores the professor a little bit, you can still perform well. So they have to talk to 10 customers every week, and they'll be on a team. So a team consists of, you know, 3 to 5. So now you're talking 40 or 50 people. Oh, and they think it's brutal. The worst thing. Well, how are we going to talk to them? We'll just walk up to them, start talking to them. But it's sort of a generational thing, and it's just they're so into text and apps, and I've really got to sort of force them to get out there and interview customers when, you know, most customers, if they are in the target demo, they'd love to talk to you, you know, they'd love to give you feedback and tell you, like, it's not a hard thing to do, you know.
I just got back from a visit to, I was actually in Reno last week and 3 weeks before that, because there were two conferences going on, one for teachers of blind students and one for the Veterans Administration working with blinded vets. And I wanted to understand if there's a use for these games in either of those two settings. So I could have kind of hoped for the best and done some web research. But instead, I flew out to Reno. I attended this conference. I paid to sponsor a breakfast or two. It cost a couple hundred dollars. And I talked to about a person every 10 minutes, 8 hours a day for 2 days. I knew I did a good job because at some point they said, you should be actually having a vendor booth here instead of accosting people in the hall. Okay, but I knew if they're saying I talked to too many people, that meant I was getting my message through, and most of the people agreed to be audio recorded as I'm talking to them so I could analyze all the results. And he determined there was a real need for what we were doing, and I could use that as marketing information to move ahead.
Sure. Yeah, that's fantastic. The other thing they commonly ask is, well, how many people do we have to talk to about X? You know, because we have different components of a business model that they're trying to validate. So, you know, we'll talk about customer relationships, value proposition, and each one of these things, you have to talk to a group of people. And so it's how many people? How many people? And I don't know if Marty will agree, but what I like to say is, until you're not getting any new information, it might not be that many people. It might be a whole lot of people, but you'll know because every single person will begin hitting on the same points and the same information. And at that point, you can say, okay, this is accurate. Let's move on to the next question, you know?
And that is so true. And the other thing, if you can do, is be it a survey or an audio recording or a video recording when you're talking to these people, because that gives you a chance to, after the fact, analyze what they said as opposed to your quick impressions as you're talking to them, because when you're talking to somebody, you're thinking about your next question. You're not really listening. If you have an ability and they agree to be recorded, then you can go back and analyze it, transcribe it, analyze it, and really get actual data to say this is either a good idea or not.
Yeah, or you can even have someone else listen to it if you go about it that way, because you, as the founder and entrepreneur, especially inexperienced ones, have a tendency to just hear so well the pleasant things that are positive, and you can almost omit those negative things. You kind of miss them even on the tape. Whereas if you get someone objective to listen to the tape, you can say, hey, this is a real problem. We've got to do something about X, Y, Z, and they might even overlook it.
That's true.
Well, we're going to jump into Travis Neal here. He's a student at FAU, so we have a guest on our show. Travis, have a question for Marty?
Yeah, Marty, offshoring, talk about outsourcing your company's labor outside of the country to maybe where the labor is cheaper. I know you're a big fan of bootstrapping and funding everything yourself from the beginning, but when you're doing that, sometimes you have to take the least expensive road. What's your stance on that?
Inevitably, outsourcing, especially outsourcing the development of a piece of software, is very complex, and unless you're an engineer and can put describe what you want in an engineering terms, it's going to end up costing you as much to outsource as it is to build it within the United States. It's better to bring on a partner, basically paying him or her via stock, and have somebody trusted and very, very expert in their field to do that. They'll be invested with you. They'll see the company and the product grow with you, and you'll be much more in control of the situation.
All right, I've got another hot or not. So you found a clear niche and a clear way to monetize mobile applications. But for someone who's looking to start a business today, mobile application development as a business model, hot or not, generally speaking?
I'm not sure I answered your question. Are you saying being in the business of writing apps for somebody else, or coming up with your own idea for an app and then pursuing it?
Coming up with your own idea for an app and pursuing that as a business venture, as opposed to an educational exercise or a hobby or any other reason you might do it.
If the app is going to solve someone's pain that you verify by talking to literally dozens and dozens of people, it's probably a worthwhile venture, because even when you're talking to these people, they'll tell you how much they'll spend, and then you can work the numbers backwards, whether it's worth to build it and the market's big enough.
All right. Well, I got another question then. Being in the app space, instead of hot or not, what are the hottest apps? What are the ones you use day to day, week to week, over time? What do you love in the app store?
Google Maps.
Okay, sure. Everybody's got that one. You're not a Waze guy?
No. Yelp.
Okay.
For picking the right things in the cities I'm at. Facebook, LinkedIn.
Any apps that that we wouldn't be familiar with that you think are particularly hot? Those probably are kind of mainstays.
I tend to be a Luddite.
Okay.
Well, I'll share a couple of mine. One of my favorites, slickdeals.net. You like a bargain, go on there. It's a forum site, and when the deal gets enough likes, it moves to the front page. Pretty neat. You know, you start buying stuff on Amazon, Staples, you know, sporting goods stores, and it's just a fun little hobby. Check it, you know, once a week, you know, once a day, and it's a neat app. Another neat app on the computer, Honey. You know, you literally, instead of searching for coupon codes, you type in, you know, click
Honey,
one button.
The browser extension that automatically enters the code.
Awesome.
Yeah, you know, that's pretty slick.
You're about to check out somewhere at Wayfair.com, click a button, and boom, you got $50 off, and you don't have to waste all that time. Something I want as an app, if you could build this for me, Marty, whenever I go to like Costco or BJ's, like all these places have all these gazillion coupons. And they expect you to cut them all out. I'd rather just have an app on my phone, go right to the register, just put your phone face down, and it will just circulate every single coupon. 3 minutes later, your discount arrives. Kind of like Honey, but on the version of when you check out at the store.
Yeah, I think the tricky component of engineering that is knowing, like, because they have so many coupons. Like, they've got to know what's in your cart. I mean, if you build that app, Marty, I'm going to be really irritated if I end up behind Jason in the line. You know, he sets his phone on there. It's just going through thousands of coupons. He's saving like 50 cents at a time. I can't get out of the store. It's going to be ridiculous.
It's Boca Raton. Come on. This is the savings area of the country right here.
I got to keep it moving, man. Yeah. I don't like that.
That's
idea.
A good niche down here. Okay, well. It was a great hot or not segment, Marty. We're going to take a quick commercial break to hear from one of our sponsors. When we jump back, we're going to jump into our Plead the Fifth segment, so don't change the channel. Welcome back to the Shrimp Tank in the Boca Raton studio, where street arts and book smarts collide. I'm your host, Jason Hill, sitting with my co-host, Kevin Cox, director over the FAU Adams Center. Definitely catch all the different episodes on iTunes, as well as Boca Raton Shrimp Tank Podcast.com. Having a really awesome episode. Going to interview Marty Schultz, so definitely, if you missed any of the segment, got to check some of the replay out. So we're going to jump into one of our favorite segments of this show. We're going to jump into the Plead the Fifth segment. You know, last week, Claudio made it through, but most guests have not, Marty. So we're going to jump in and I'm going to let Kevin over here, you know, see if he gets you on round one. Go ahead, Kevin.
All right. So, Marty, you only get to plead the fifth one time. I'm going to go back to the well on the private angel investing area. I can't imagine all of these investments paid off. So what's the worst or most challenging investment you made as an angel, or an investment, regardless of the outcome, that you regret?
Since it was investment of my time, like I said, it's been very rare that I've actually invested money. Okay. But investing my time, I've dumped weeks or months into working on something. We had one idea where we would work with private jet charters, and we were using a Google search algorithm before Google changed all their methodologies. And using an outside consultant, we were able to stay on the first page, which would then drive the business. The problem was we were not in control of that business, and when Google changed their search algorithms, the company had no strategic benefit. So we ended up folding that.
Wow, interesting. We've got a couple of ventures in our accelerator right now that are still trying to figure out logistics and organization in the kind of the private flights market and make it more accessible and more efficient. There does seem to be an opportunity there, but they're working to figure it out at the moment.
Our only barrier at that point was our being top in search, and that barrier didn't last for long. If you don't have a barrier, you really don't have a business.
Sure.
Okay, I got one for you. What's the worst pitch you ever heard? You sit on all these boards, someone says, I have this great company, and you heard it, and it's the worst thing you've ever heard of. Will you tell us that story?
Probably the pitch of one of my first companies, which is I thought simply by making computers cheaper for people to buy with the software on it, more people would buy it. What I found was, and this was working through a reseller, if a reseller can sell a computer for $5,000 or $50,000, I thought if it's only $5,000, they'd sell a lot more of them. I didn't realize at the time until I went through this business for a couple of years that companies can only sell what they can sell. They can't suddenly grow their business by a factor of 10 just because what they're selling is cheaper.
Interesting. Okay, so it can be your most recent company, Blindfold Games, or one of your previous experiences, because I know you have so many. Who is or was your most hated competition and why?
That was probably the competitor we had when I did that very first company, where they had a product just like our product. It was the first time I was competing in the industry, and I used to hate them because they had most of the customers and I didn't. And every customer I had to grow by, I had to steal one of their customers. And we eventually grew our business to be about equal to them through a lot of very hard work. And in the end, I ended up selling my company to them as an exit.
Nice.
What's the worst marketing you've ever personally done, you know, in your business? You did a lot of guerrilla marketing. Can you share that, you know, those early day stories? And you look back and you're like, thankfully, I'm not doing that now with the audience. Will you share that story?
Was it
knocking on doors? Was it, you know, something in the cafeteria room, you know, that you did?
Probably anything? The worst marketing was when I was 13 years old and I came up with this idea of photographing all the houses on the street where my parents had a house. And I thought I would take a picture of these people's houses because I was into photography, print the picture. This is before, obviously, iPhones could do it, just back in the days of cameras and enlargers and developing film yourself, and then sell the pictures to the people on the street because they had this house. I figured they'd want a picture of their house.
Did you talk to these customers first?
No.
So that's when you learned.
So
that,
I went door to door with a finished product, the photo of their house, hoping that somebody would pay me a dollar for that. Nobody did.
Yeah,
I'm surprised. I think, you know.
Really? What? Would young, you want a picture of your
house? 13 years old. He's like, look what I did. I did this for you. I'm
a
neighbor.
It's only a dollar. Yeah, like a pity sale.
Yeah, I would have been far more successful if I was like 7 or 8. But 13, by the time you're 13, you know, maybe a little hint of some hair on your face for a mustache. You just look like a nasty kid.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, Marty's pretty open too. What's the ideal exit strategy for Blindfold Games or Endgame, if it's not an exit?
I don't see right now an endgame for Blindfold Games because it's more of a social good entity. Yeah. And right now we have about 20,000 game fans who are on iPhones. According to my analysis, it's somewhere between 50 and 100,000 visually impaired people who own iPhones. So we've only scratched about a third or so of the market, and it's just expanding into helping more people enjoy the games.
Okay. Well, we talked a lot about your worst investment with time. So what's your worst investment with real money? What did you do in all these businesses that you look back and your biggest regret, and you did lose a big chunk of money?
Never lost a big chunk of money in any private venture. Lost a lot of big chunk of money each time we had a recession. My personal wealth probably went down each time by about a third.
How much is a third? You can still plead the fifth.
Oh, you got him. I don't think he's going to be able to say this.
I don't remember.
No, you have to answer. What's the number?
It was 2008. I don't remember.
I think I don't remember equals I plead the fifth.
Yeah, I think I right? score the point. That one don't go to me.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was your last time. Okay. Well, Travis, you got a question? We have Travis, an intern at FAU, going to try to get one last plead the fifth in.
You mentioned every company that you've invested a year or so of your life or more into, you've had a good exit strategy or went public with. So many impressive things just in that one statement. Tell us about, did you have a venture that was a failure or had a major failure that made you want to walk away from it?
Oh, every company I've done has hit a point where it's been a major failure and then we would have to pivot to something else. So even in the McGruff parental control software, we actually started that company out thinking we were going to help businesses figure out what their employees were doing online to protect them in certain situations. That basically went over like a lead balloon. So we had to pivot and ended up in the parental control market. Every company basically that I've done had to go through a pivot.
Okay. And last question of the day. you know, exit strategy? You know, what made you exit each time, and how do you do that exit? Explain, a lot of folks never even get to that point.
Usually an exit strategy is caused by an internal company event. One of the partners isn't happy and you have to figure out what to do. With the education technology company, there was a company who wanted to do a roll up of companies just like ours. And we had the exit strategy from that. With the McGruff company, we ended up doing an exit because another company was doing roll ups. In the communication company, we first went public and then we ended up selling, that company to, again, a company doing a roll-up.
Yeah. Well, you're a great person to contact. I guess if anyone's in South Florida and needs to discuss an exit strategy, I'm sure you have some great connections that could help those entrepreneurs out or business owners, right? Well, Marty, thanks for coming on the Shrimp Tank today. For the audience listening, how could they get in touch with you? They want you to come speak, you know, in front of their audience, or they want a consulting gig to learn, you know, about what you've done and how you could help them. How could they get in touch?
Yeah, the easiest way to reach me is marty@blindfoldgames.org. You can follow me on Twitter @blindfoldgames. You could also reach me on Twitter and follow me @MartySchultz111. And you can visit my website for speaking, which is MartySchultz.net.
Well, thanks again for coming out to the Shrimp Tank today. I'm your host, Jason Hill, Kevin Cox, and to my right over here,